We began a series on family about 3 weeks ago, and as part of that, I threatened you at the time that Karen and I would unload on you all that we know about parenting. So, yeah, it shouldn't take too long. And I realise that there's quite a few families that aren't here this morning, and I also realise that for many of you, you're not directly impacted by parenting. But you are impacted by grandparenting. Some of you have a lot of contact with children, and some of you are teachers. And so I hope that that you'll be able to glean something from what's shared this morning. We're going to speak from our experience, and there's a biblical framework for that, of course. This is not necessarily an expository sermon. So if there's no formal structure to this, as there normally is, then my apologies, but we just want to share from our experience and ground that in the scripture. I do want to say that this is a way, our way, but it's not necessarily the only way. And so we're not here as professionals saying to you, look, we have nailed this parenting thing, and our book on parenting is coming out in 3 weeks' time. Look out for it in your local Christian bookshop, and we're not going there with this message this morning. So hopefully you'll glean from it, or you'll be impacted by our vulnerability and the mistakes that we've made as well along the way. The other thing I want to mention too is that we've had the privilege of having a stable marriage relationship for over 25 years. So the context in which we're speaking is husband and wife, been together for that time. And I realise that for some of you here this morning, that's not necessarily your experience. So you may be, your family may be a blended family, you may be a single parent. That's certainly the experience in the wider community. So again, I just hope that some of the things that we say this morning will be helpful to you. All right, well, I'm going to ask Karen to introduce our family. They're not here, but we're still going to introduce them to you. Well, Ruben's here, but I mean the whole... Sorry. We're off to a bad start.
Just let me do it.
Okay, way to go.
Okay, so for those of you who don't know, John and I have three children, and so far three grandchildren. Hey? Timothy is our eldest son, who is 25 and married to Tricia. And they have two children, Tama, who is 2.5, and Maya, who's just gone 5 months. Tim and Trick have just moved to Brisbane on changing jobs a couple of months ago. Tim now works for a debt collecting company, and Tricia is a stay-at-home mum. Shreya is our daughter, who's 23 and married to Troy, and they have their first child, Nehemiah, or Neo, who is nearly 5 months old. Troy and Shreya live in Maryborough, and Troy works as a baker, bus driver, and auxiliary firey, and is training and hoping for employment with the fire department one day. Reuben is our youngest and second son, and he's 16.5 and lives at home with us most of the time. He has been studying his Cert 3 in Information Digital Media and Technology this year and is planning to do his diploma in the same next year.
Thank you. Well, before we get into some specifics this morning, I just want to share with you, or we want to share with you, some three big ideas about family. And the first big idea is that early on we decided, or Karen decided, that Karen would be a stay-at-home mum. So I'm going to... let her share about that.
Okay. So right from the outset, my dream was, all I wanted to do was be a mum. And God willing, I've been able to fulfill that dream. As soon as we married, I gave up full-time work and worked part-time for nearly 12 months in the church we attended at the time until I was about 6 months pregnant with Tim. This was a choice that we made, and fortunately we were able to continue with this for most part of our married life. There have been times I'd like to call seasons when I had to work outside the home, even though not in paid work. For instance, when we started a Christian school in the Whitsundays, I was the administration officer, come bursar, come anything else that needed doing. But during that time, I was still able to be there for our two children at the time and was only tied up with this job during school hours. Then Reuben came along and we had to find someone to take over my position. I find my role as a pastor's wife busy enough, not just physically, but also emotionally, to be able to tackle anything else.
The other thing we want to say with that is that we realise that in some circumstances that's just not possible, and to have the luxury of one at home, stay-at-home mum or stay-at-home dad, and in many circumstances there needs to be two streams of income for the family to survive. When you've got average mortgages of $300,000, $400,000, that's just a reality in some circumstances. So we just wanted to validate that as well. We're not saying to you that, you know, you must stay at home as a stay-at-home mum. So that's where we're coming from in that. The other big idea that we wanted to share is that our family is a family in a ministry context. So right from the time that we had Timothy, I was studying, training for ministry. So that has been the context in which we have raised our family. So two really important things for us in that. One was that we wanted to normalize family life. In other words, we wanted to make sure that there was space and time for us to be a family outside of the context of ministry. That was really important for us. But the other thing, and this is the flip side to that comment, we wanted to include our kids in the ebb and flow of ministry life as well. So that's been a juggling act and sometimes a fine balance for the 25 years that we've been in ministry and had a family and still have a family. The third big idea that we want to communicate with you this morning is that we always wanted to and still enjoy our kids, and Karen's going to share a bit more about that.
So we believe that God wants us to enjoy our kids. In some ways, parenting is an occupation of sorts, but it shouldn't be a chore or a burden. So you need to give them your time and enjoy them.
Yeah, and we wanted to enjoy our kids through all stages of their life, through, you know, their childhood and into their emerging adulthood. And we wanted, and I don't know that we actually sat down and articulated this, but I think intuitively we wanted to enjoy our children in their adult years, and we wanted a circumstance and environment in which they would want to come home, you know, not just leave and never see you again because they'd had enough of you, but we wanted them to feel free to come home and that we would enjoy their company, and we do that. I've always enjoyed my kids, and I know that there's been horror stories about parents and teenagers, and I actually found, and we found together, I think, that the teenage years were great. I loved my kids as people. So, well, we're going to change gear a little bit, and we're going to talk about that wonderful concept of discipline, and I want to say to you a few things before we dive into this. The first is this, that discipline is actually a biblical concept. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5, we read, you know, don't despise the Lord's discipline, because the Lord disciplines those that he loves like a father disciplines his children. So we want to ground the concept of discipline in the Bible, that the discipline is actually a biblical concept. The other thing I want to say about discipline is it's the short word in discipleship. And parenting is as much about discipling your children as it is about anything else. In fact, that may be the most critical element, that you are producing disciples as parents and you are wanting them to follow you, but ultimately you're wanting them to follow Jesus. So there's a strong discipling dimension to parenting. We believe, and this comes about with experience but also research reading. Karen has got a couple of shelves of parenting books at home. But we believe that there are four critical stages of parenting. And the first is actually the stage of discipline. And this happens, roughly speaking, between the ages of 1 and 5. The focus time of discipline. So I want to say, this is the big picture statement, that children need to know that there's someone bigger, smarter, who is in control of the family. There's someone who will provide for them boundaries and a framework in which they can live. Now, I want to say that because sometimes the voice of our culture says different, and I want to encourage those of you who are in this mode of disciplining your children, that your kids actually need the security of you as someone who will discipline mum and dad. And Karen's going to speak about the different ways that our children responded to different forms of discipline.
Okay, so firstly, I'd just like to read Ephesians 6:4 to you. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but raise them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. And I looked up what a disciple is. And the meaning of disciple that I found is a disciple is a follower and student of a mentor, teacher, or other figure. So I guess we're the other figure there. But anyway, the first stage of discipline that I'd like to talk about is approximately the ages 1 to 5 and how our kids were very different when it came to disciplining them. So we believed in smacking as part of discipline. I know some of you probably don't, but that was what we believed in at the time. Now, for example, Tim, he had a very high pain threshold. So you could smack him and he would just laugh at you. I once broke a wooden spoon on him. Admittedly, it was a very, very weak wooden spoon. But honestly, he didn't even feel it. And another example of that was not through discipline, but I remember when he was crawling at my mum and dad's place, they had a brick archway, and he crawled head first straight into the corner of it. Didn't even cringe. So, you know, that was his pain threshold was just very high. Smacking really didn't help. Whereas Shireya, I remember giving her a smack on the hand and telling her no, not to touch something or something of the like, when she was a toddler. And after that, you only had to raise your voice or look at her the wrong way and she would burst into tears. So you didn't need to smack her after that, you know, because, she knew you were the one in charge and she'd done the wrong thing. And then Reuben came along. And the other two had him sorted because they were obviously a fair bit older than him. So I don't think we hardly smacked Reuben at all, although he does say that we did at some stages. But he would laugh and joke about things and have everyone in stitches, and by that time we'd forgotten what he'd done wrong anyway. So he was, they were all very quite easily disciplined. Not that smacking is the only form of discipline, and it was probably our first initial, you know, your first reaction, and sometimes it is out of anger, which it shouldn't be, but you do just, you know, you do that initially. But we also used a lot of time out and just separation from the other siblings, which was where most conflict comes from with that age of kids. I can't remember any of our kids really being what you'd call naughty or very naughty, you know, very naughty. I think you need to learn to distinguish the difference between being naughty and just childish irresponsibility, which most kids are at that stage of life. And you don't punish them for being childish. You know, you've got to distinguish that. And a couple of things to remember with this is, firstly, that mums are equal disciplinarians. Don't think that because you're the mum, you're not able to discipline them. You're smart enough and equally equipped as fathers to discipline your children. Okay? As mothers, what did I say? Oh, sorry, as mothers. So never say, wait till your father gets home, okay? It's not fair on your child or your husband for him to have to come home to that. So you need to, and I mean, you need to do it there and then. You shouldn't let the kid wait until how many hours later. And secondly, pick your battles. You know, what I mean by this is, if they've done is dishonest, disobedient, or disrespectful, then that needs to be treated and dealt with appropriately. But, if not, you might need to leave it alone. That's it.
Well done. I just want to say a couple of things on this stage of the child's development and discipline. And discipline is actually about restoring broken relationships. So if we think about the gospel message is about God restoring a broken relationship with us. So it's very important when you discipline your children that you take whatever disciplinary measures you feel you need to, but then you side with them against whatever has caused that misbehavior. So that you discipline your children, but it's not about vengeance and it's not about anger. It's about you siding with them saying, you know, I'm standing with you against whatever it is that's going on in your little heart at the moment. And in that sense, it's actually a gospel, it's gospel related, because that's what God did. God sent his son, Jesus, to stand with us against the sin and the evil in our heart. Do you understand that? So that's really important to remember and discipline. The other thing about this particular age and stage is that many parents are afraid that they're afraid of their kids, maybe. They're actually afraid that their children won't like them. And so I want to say to you that this is just a season, and sometimes it feels like a really intense season, that you're disciplining your children continually, continually. And it is just a season of time, and your children will like you, but later, and I want to say this, later is longer. So once you're through that really difficult, continual, on your toes discipline period, your children will like you. But it's later is longer. So we're going to talk about the next stage now, which is training. And Karen's going to say a few things. No, I am. Okay. Just a couple of things I want to say about training. And this is roughly the age of 5 to 12. And in training, you are actually teaching your children life. So you're looking for teaching opportunities. You're looking for circumstances in which you can bed into your children morality and all of those things that will stand them in good stead in the years to come. There's one or two things that parents will tend to do in this stage of life, and it's this, that they'll often bail out their children. So I would say to you, don't bail, let them fail. It's very important that in this stage of life, in the training process, that you allow your children to fail, because failure in this time of their life is not a necessarily a bad thing. The stakes are lower and the risks are less. And if they don't learn these life lessons in this kind of formative time from 5 to 12, maybe a bit more, there is overlap obviously here. If they don't learn these lessons at this time, they'll learn them later in life where the stakes are higher and the risks are greater. So it's a very important thing that you don't always bail out your children. For example, you know, little Johnny comes home from school and says to Mum that the teacher gave him a really, really bad time, hard time. He was treated unfairly. The normal response of parents is to bail them out, at least emotionally, maybe to charge down to the school and give the teacher an earful. But that's actually a good opportunity to teach a child. If there has been injustice or unfairness in that circumstance, that's actually a good opportunity to teach that child how to respond when an authority in their life treats them unfairly. So I just want to say, those of you who are in this stage of your parenting where you're training your children, don't always bail them out. There is still a soft fall because they're young, but teach them life lessons. You've got to pick these as well. Like, if they're jumping off the roof, you've got to catch them, right? So there's some drastic things that can happen, but allow them to fail, for want of a better word, at this stage. And just remember too that the scriptures say, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's older or she's older, they will not depart from it. What that actually means is recognize the individuality of your children and how they respond to different information and stimuli, and understand that they will have a unique path in life which is different from their siblings. So you actually need to identify that in them and train them in that sense. So that's the training stage. We'll move on. The next stage in child's development is 12 to 18, and this is what we like to call the coaching stage. Did you want to say anything about this? No, okay. You can see who did all the hard work between, you know, year 5 and year 18. Just kidding. In the coaching stage, you, which is roughly between 12 and 18, it varies, bearing in mind that our son was married about 3 weeks before his 19th birthday, so there's a bit of overlap and a bit of latitude in all of this. But in the coaching stage, what you're wanting to do is you're wanting to release your children into greater areas of decision-making and responsibility. This is actually quite a difficult stage in their development, and it's difficult for you as a parent because you're beginning to step back and you're beginning to release them more and more into who they are, into the decisions that they need to make. And one of the key things I think in this stage, because we're talking about teenagers, is don't freak out, right? Some of you know what I mean by this, that it's very important for you sometimes as a parent in this stage of your life to have a poker face, to keep your poker face, because there's things that will happen in the life of your teen that will actually horrify you, but you don't want to necessarily express that there and then in the moment. Do you know what I mean? It's very important for your teen to realize that you've actually got this under control, so that when your teen comes home, first time that he or she's ever driven, and they tell you that they've taken a 90-degree corner at 80 k's an hour and they got the car up on two wheels, you know, as a parent, or something like that, as a parent, you just freak out. You just freak out. But they need to know in that moment that they can actually tell you that and it's okay. And then a week later, you circle back on that issue and you say to them, maybe there was a better way to take the corner in those circumstances, in those conditions. So sometimes it's very important, because psychologically, we as people are still children and we're still adolescents, as well as the fact that we're adults. And sometimes in those moments of panic, we actually regress from adulthood into adolescence, and we crumble and we freak out. And it's very important in the coaching stage that you stay strong and rather resilient. And then you go behind closed doors and you turn into a basket case, but your kids need to know that you've got this covered. So that's the coaching. That's my advice on coaching. You're welcome. I think it's very important in the coaching stage that you do all that you can to listen non-judgmentally to your children, that you keep communication lines open, and that there are still boundaries for behavior, but you continue to release them, and that you trust all of the work that you've invested in them in the past. The final stage in the development of children is the friendship stage. And here's a big mistake that many parents make. They want to be friends with their children too early. And I've seen this and you've seen this, parents surrendering their parental role in favor of being the friend of the child. And that is the ultimate goal, but you can do that too early in the developmental process. There is a sense in which you'll always be friends with your children, hopefully not enemies. But you know what I mean, that releasing of the parent-child relationship too soon is too harmful. So that final stage is around about 18 and on, when you really do want friendship with your children. And we enjoy that. We enjoy that stage. Even though we still have a teen at home, we're still friends. Well, we were before we came. So, okay, we're going to move on. We're going to change gears again, and we're going to talk about affirmation. And I want to say to you, when it comes to rejection and acceptance, those key things begin in the home. Rejection or acceptance begin in the home. And Karen's going to talk a bit more about that. Talking about affirmation.
Talking about affirmation here. So firstly, I'd just like to say, be careful what you say to your kids. Okay, mainly with boys, don't tell them to man up or be a man, because you're being disrespectful to them. I mean, we're talking about boys, you know. They're not a man, and don't expect them to be. Those sort of phrases can emotionally affect them for a long, long time. So, you know, remember what age they are and who they are as an individual. And also don't call them names. Don't call them idiot, stupid. Address the action, not the person.
Yeah. The words are very powerful, and the words that you use have the capacity to build up and encourage. They also have the potential to tear down and destroy. You know, there's many times where I've actually regretted what I've said to my children, not necessarily the content of what I've said, but the manner in which I've said it. So, again, acceptance and rejection begin in the home, and it's very important that we affirm our children, and we use words to encourage, to fortify, to strengthen. This is really modeled on the Old Testament, where fathers would bless their children. This is something that we don't think about very often these days, where the blessing was imparted from the father down to the children. And this often happened at key and critical times in their development. Actually, it happened in their movement from childhood into adolescence, something called the bar mitzvah, the coming of age, or the bat mitzvah for the girls. And so the blessing of the father imparted to the children was spoken through words. And that is something that we have lost, or maybe we've never really had much in our culture. Our son Neo was dedicated, grandson. Feels like a son sometimes. Our grandson Neo was dedicated about a month ago. And in that dedication prayer, the pastor stopped and prayed a blessing on him. There was about 10 specific things that he blessed him for and over. One of the things that he blessed him in was his gender. He said to Neo, "We bless your gender. We thank God that God has chosen that you would be a male." And I'm just wondering about the powerful impact that is, as that's reinforced over the years in him. And the same for a girl. We bless your gender. We bless the Lord because he's seen fit that you are a girl, and we bless that. And I wonder over time whether that mightn't reduce the problem that we have with sexual orientation in our culture, where kids are confused about their sexuality because it hasn't been blessed and affirmed in appropriate ways over the years. So affirmation is very important. So affirmation comes in two ways, in the words that we use, and we won't say anything more about that, but it also comes in the schedule that we choose. So we're going to take a few moments to talk about family time.
Okay, so in family time, we're, because often you hear, you know, quality, quantity, and I don't believe that it's quality or quantity time, but regular time, okay? So firstly on that, we had, through our family life or stages in our family life, we'd have family nights. These consisted of specific night of the week where we'd do an activity at home, usually chosen by one of the kids. The activities included things like a movie, playing board games together, or some other idea that the kids had. We haven't done these all the time, but on different occasions. Another thing we do was annual holidays. We'd always have time every year where we'd have at least one time a year where we'd have an annual holiday away from the home for a couple of weeks. We often came to Rainbow Beach, which also built a family tradition, which is almost as important as having the time.
One of the other important elements in family time is focused attention, so that you actually spend time one-on-one as parents with your children. And we attempted to do that over the years. We would take, you know, one of the kids out to a movie or whatever it might be, or just around the home, there would be focused attention. It's not something that we did perfectly, and it's not something that we did perhaps as consistently as we could have. But I think it's important for those of you who have maybe three or four children in your family, that you spend focused time with each of those kids in some way, shape or form. One of the memorable things for me was when I took Timothy, our eldest son, I took him away for the, you know, the man to boy talk, and we came up to Rainbow Beach here, but we stopped overnight at the little caravan park on the north shore of Rainbow Beach, on the north shore of Noosa, sorry. And we got there about 5 o'clock. We went down to the beach, mucked around a little bit. There was not much else to do, so we came home, came back to the campsite, cooked a bit of tea, and we went to bed about 7 o'clock. So here's the two of us lying in bed, 7 o'clock that night, and couldn't go to sleep. So we tossed and turned all night, and I think sometime before midnight, we had the talk. And then the next day, we came up to Rainbow Beach and did a bit of fishing and went home. But it's very important that you spend focused time with each of your kids. All right, we're going to talk now finally about family and faith. And Karen's going to kick that off. Are you? Yes.
Okay. Just talking about faith in the family and teachable moments. Just an example of that, when we were at Gateway Church, when we lived in Brisbane, Tim would come home from Sunday school with a story sheet that he'd learnt from Sunday school. It'd have a story on one side and a picture on the other, which he'd coloured in generally. And then through that week, we would read that story to him at bedtime to sort of instill what he'd learnt on Sunday. So after a couple of nights of reading that to him, he could then recite it back to you. So he would read it to you, or not read it because he couldn't read, but tell it to you word for word. So, you know, that instilling of that, you know, even though he was only rote learning it, he was remembering it. So that's, you know, an important thing. So at times we did do structured things, you know, things like that. And especially when I homeschooled the kids at different times, we would have specific times where we'd do devotions or structured things like that, to build into them their faith in God. But mostly we wanted to just teach them through our daily example, that we felt that was more important than all those specific times, our daily example to them of that.
And this is probably going to offend the guys who are involved in Navigators, but I do want to say that I think that in the family, the intersection of faith and life is perhaps more important even than scripture memory. So as Karen said, there were times when we had structured devotions, and many times that we didn't. But our main concern was that for our children, their faith was grounded in real life, and there was that intersection of what they were hearing, but more than that, what they were seeing, and the reality of that for their lives. And so we were quite open about talking about circumstances, talking about when, you know, God provided for us financially. That was always a topic of conversation. These things were the intersection of faith and life. And we felt, rightly or wrongly, that that was more important than the religious daily devotion, which I'm not knocking, by the way, because that discipline is a good thing, but there were times when that was just not practical for our children and for us because of life. So in all of that, we didn't want our children to feel the pressure of having to be perfect pastor's kids, and they never were, and they never will be, because that's just not the expectation that we had on them. We just wanted them to find their own journey with God and to give them space to do that, while ever we gave some structure and framework around that. And that has actually happened by the grace of God.
Another thing is not just our input either. I mean, we're one party to input, but there are so many other avenues which can be inputted, like the Sunday school teacher, the church family, and you as a church family individually into each of the kids in this congregation's lives and their faith.
And we were very intentional about the sorts of family relationships that we developed in church to church, and in particular when we were in Maryborough, because that was probably the most formative time in the lives of our children, we were quite intentional about the family relationships that we developed, which our children benefited from in the sense that for Tim, that he found a wife out of one of those families. So that's, you know, that's pretty good. So, so that's a good thing that you can do as a parent. You can think about the intentionality of your relationships and how that influences and affects your children. We just want to, time's got away, we want to finish with this thought that probably the best gift that you can give to your children is a good marriage. Ours is a good marriage. It's not a perfect marriage. We're two imperfect people, but we have tried to model for our children what it means to be a husband and wife, real people, but committed to each other over the long haul. And so that's it. That's all we've got on parenting. Realize that many of you have got probably deeper and further experiences to that, but we just thought we'd take this opportunity just to share with you a bit of our story, and hopefully it's helped along the way. And again, for those of you who have parented and you're graduated from that, sorry that you had to sit through this, but hopefully it's been helpful to those who are kind of immediately in that circumstance. So thank you.